Good afternoon. Welcome to a session on a couple variance papers.
Cut down the input.
My name's Roger Hain. I'm a fellow with the Casualty Actuarial Society. I also happen to be Vice President R&D for the CAS, and have been honored to have had a paper accepted in the premier issue of variance, and I'm quite proud of that. But all of that pales in insignificance to my pride in being on the same panel with the illustrious Greg Taylor from Australia. My respect and admiration of Greg goes back many, many years, and one of the finest actuaries I know. So anyway, enough for the Mutual Recognition Society here. And let's get on. This is interesting. The output doesn't quite seem to be complete. Oh, shucks. I wonder if, see what I'm saying? I don't recall. I'm sorry, as you can tell, the slide doesn't quite come all the way across, but it does on my screen. I know what I can try here.
That's probably something in his projector.
Or it could be something here. Let me try something first. Okay, does that seem like we've got everything? Probably not, but we'll try it again. Let's see how that works. Nope, doesn't go.
I'm not sure if that's his projector.
Okay, yeah. Wait, hold on. Let me see about this slideshow. Maybe it's me. Oh, we got it going. Good. Service contracts tend to be generally a casualty line, and tend to have properties quite different than most other property casualty contracts of insurance. Because of that, there are a number of pitfalls that people fall into when trying to analyze a service contract book of business, or are called on to assess the profitability of a company that writes service contract or is related to it. Complicating that are various structures of both administration and insurance of these contracts that make life a little bit more interesting too. So with these unique characteristics and some abuses that we've seen happen in the industry, I figured it was, also at the request of some folks who wanted to have a primer, I decided to try to put down some basic thoughts and basic observations about service contracts together in a paper. And took a flyer, submitted it to Variance, and to my surprise, it was accepted. So, and as I said, I'm honored to have it appear in the premier edition. So let's start off with some basics. What are service contracts? Oh, and by the way, if you have any questions anywhere along my presentation, please don't hesitate to stop me. I tend to let my audience control the speed. And, if you think I'm kind of talking fast now, wait until I've built up a little bit of momentum. So if you want to slow me down, just raise your hand. Ask an inane question like, how do you spell service? It'll slow me down a little bit. But if there's any point that's not clear, please let me know. So what are service contracts? Well, service contract's an agreement to repair or replace a product if it fails for specific reasons. Now you can get a service contract for just about anything. You go to Kmart or I don't know about Kmart. I think Walmart's starting to do it. I know if you go to like Best Buy and buy a $40 Discman, they'll offer to sell you a service contract for $40 to replace it. You know, I kind of wonder about things like that. The economics, but some people do. Motor vehicles, that's historically, the first service contracts I've heard of were on appliances, believe it or not, but in the 70s and 80s, they started writing them on motor vehicles, and things got real interesting because, you can charge a whole lot more for a service contract on a motor vehicle than you can on a washer or dryer. RVs, travel trailers, watercraft, homes and home systems, appliances, electronics, TVs, cameras, camcorders, Discmen, iPods, you name it, computers and peripherals. Things that, the general provisions in service contracts are usually limited by time. A year, 2 years, a month, 10 years. Can be a little as a month. If you look at your cell phone contracts, some people will sell you a service contract on your cell phone, and it goes on a month-to-month basis. 10 years. Actual warranties on houses go 10 years. There are some car service contracts that go 10 years. Related are manufacturer warranties. Subaru has got 10-year coverage, and GM just recently introduced 10 years on their powertrain. Generally will involve fortuitous events. The tax man doesn't like you to deduct income if all you're doing is deferring known costs. So, maintenance contracts that say, yes, I'm going to change your oil every 3 months, they tend not to be looked at as insurance. They are treated as a different kind of an animal. So typically service contracts cover fortuitous events. And there's generally an agreement to repair or replace, and usually with exclusions, act of God, misuse, theft, wear and tear. So if you got your service contract, they don't really like covering you for drag racing down the street and when you blow the, shoot the rod through the cylinder head. This is not a good thing. And they kind of frown on that and don't want to repair it. But very importantly, and really which causes a lot of interesting characteristics with these things, it's secondary to manufacturer warranties. Generally, when you buy something, the manufacturer says, well, if it don't work, we'll fix it for you. And it's not usually if it don't work, we'll fix it for you forever. It's if it don't work, we'll fix it for you for a little bit, a certain amount of time. With cars, it's time and mileage. And typically, service contracts are excess or secondary to the manufacturer or OEM warranty. They're also secondary to or usually exclude things that would normally be covered by insurance, things like collision, glass breakage, theft, and those sorts of things. For motor vehicles, usually there's both time and mileage limitations. Back in the 70s and early 80s, there were brilliant marketers out there that figured we'll sell unlimited mileage contracts. You don't see those anymore, and I wonder why. And again, excess of the OEM warranty. Just about all the cars have a 3-year, 36,000 mile, whichever comes first. And anytime I use a time mileage combination, just so I don't have to say it all the time, it's whichever comes first, 3 years or 30,000 miles. When I talk a 770, it's 7 years or 70,000 miles, whichever comes first. Typically, the 336 are on bumper to bumper. That's just about everything on the car, with the exception of expendable items. And as I said, GM, Subaru, et cetera, will have longer powertrain warranties on the engine, transmission, drive systems. And traditionally on motor vehicles, there used to be a dichotomy between the contracts. A new car contract, the time runs from when the vehicle was originally put into service, called the in-service date. That's when it was first titled, first sold to the first customer. And the miles run from the in-service date, so from zero odometer. So if you buy a traditional 7-year, 100,000-mile used, a new car contract, it runs 7 years or 100,000 miles from the time that vehicle was first bought, independent of which buyer you are. It becomes important because as many things in this business, the folks marketing this says, well, we've got these cars that are still really new, you know. I mean, they're only demos. They've only been driven down to show people what the car's like, and they've only got this little bit of mileage still under warranty, manufacturer's warranty. Why can't we sell one of these new car contracts? You really have no more exposure. So the administrators and insurers say, sure thing, we'll sell them, but we're going to sell them this way, with time and mileage running from the original in-service date. That way, look at this. We're going to sell this contract on a car that's a year old. We're going to get all that premium, and it's already been a year, and we're not going to have to pay losses for that year. Yeah, except that they fail to realize that there's adverse selection, and the person who's had the car for a year knows if it's a dog, and will be much more amenable to purchasing this kind of coverage if he or she thinks that they're going to be using it a lot. So selling new car contracts on cars that are actually used can be dangerous and can be expensive, as many carriers have found out. But in the traditional, back in the old days kind of thing, used cars, the contracts had the time running from when you bought the contract and the miles running from when you bought the contract. Typically, new car contracts run 5, 6, 7 years. Some are as long as 10 now. Typically, used car contracts can run anything from like 3 months to 4 years tends to be on the outside for a typical used car contract. Now, as I was saying before, you could buy these, in a lot of programs, you can buy these new car contracts for cars that are really used, as long as, you know, there are some limitations on how used. And the limitations can vary by administrator, and sometimes they're a new car is any car that's less than 4 years old with less than 60,000 miles, independent of OEM. Sometimes the marketers tend to drive things. But usually, the usual condition is that the manufacturer's warranty is still there. But there's, as I said before, there's a significant chance for adverse selection in these. But now, recently in the last, say, 4 or 5 years, there's this another kind of a new car contract that's coming up that's neither traditional fish nor fowl. In this, the time runs from the date the contract is issued, whereas the mileage runs from the in-service date or the based on the odometer. So with a traditional 7-100 new car contract sold on a car with 2 years, 24,000 miles, what you're doing is actually buying 5 years, 76,000 miles of cover on a traditional. This one, you'll be buying 7 years and 76,000 miles of coverage on the same car. A lot of people say, oh, everybody miles out before they time out. So they, you know, some folks are tempted to sell these kind of contracts for the same price that they sold the traditional new. And then when the tail comes out and starts biting them, they'll say, what the heck happened? This kind of contract gives more coverage than the traditional new car contract of the same length. So beware, be careful. Other provisions. Yeah, there's different kinds of contracts on vehicles. There's the covered parts contract, and this kind of lists the covered, you know, often the most basic is the powertrain that simply covers the engine, transmission, and drivetrain. Then there's a named parts contract that lists a fairly exhaustive list of parts, and you know, we will cover if any of these things break. You know, and they get fairly detailed. And then there's the all perils or all parts type policy that says we're going to cover everything on the car except for the following assemblies or parts. Typically, consumable items like tires, fluids, brake pads, batteries are not covered under service contracts. Tires are usually covered under a separate tire manufacturer warranty. You know, brake pads, well, those things wear out. Some of the real platinum-type coverages might throw in things like brake pads and batteries, but that's more unusual than not. Property casualty loss is another exclusion on these things. Losses covered by the manufacturer of the repair facility. another exclusion. And going to that last exclusion, that's sometimes a little surprising because manufacturers will, from time to time, put out service memos, which are little notes out to the dealers kind of telling them, hey, we noticed this particular problem with this particular make and model. If a customer brings it in for this, even though they're outside of the standard warranty, fix it for them and we'll pay you for it. Now, some dealers who might be unscrupulous, and we're not going to name names, may say, okay, we'll fix that and then charge the service contract company. So a service contract administrator or writer better know what kind of service bulletins there are out there so that they can, you know, be aware when the not-so-scrupulous dealers are trying to collect again. And we all know what the kind of reputation car dealers have. Very trustworthy and honest, right along with insurance agents. Anyway, again, they usually cover items not covered under the OEM warranty. But, you know, things, you figure since you got the OEM warranty, there should be no losses in the early stages. Well, these contracts do cover other things, like towing. It could very well be that the manufacturer's warranty will not cover towing your car into the shop, but the service contract might. A service contract could cover trip interruption. You're out on your vacation and you're, you know, driving along and boom, you get a breakdown and you have to figure out where to stay for an extra day in a hotel or something. Sometimes the service contracts will pick that up. Rental car sometimes will pick up, even if the manufacturer's warranty won't. So there's possibility that you can get losses in the early stages of contract even when the OEM warranty is in effect. They are generally transferable, usually with the payment of a fee, but not to another dealer. So if you sell your car to John down the street for $25 and filling out the paperwork, you send it in, and John can get the rest of your service contract. Usually the contract writers like to think that you're going to forget about that and make some money on you, but it's available. But if you sell it to a dealer, they don't get to transfer it. It can be canceled by the purchaser of the contract, but not by the insured. So it falls into the 13-month or longer, and we'll get into that in a little bit. For new homes, technically this is a product warranty. It's not a service contract. In certain situations, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, will require certain protections in order to guarantee loans. 1 year on workmanship, that's basically the first year you own a house, the contractor pretty much has to come in and fix things that are wrong with it. 2 years on major systems like heating, air conditioning, plumbing, and that sort of thing, and a total of 10 years on the structure. These are typically required. Now, a lot of builders will want to walk away from a project after a while. They don't want to be around a project for 10 years, even if they are in business. And, you know, builders sometimes, you know, kind of come in business for a while for a few projects and then go out of business and, you know, just kind of disappear. So often what happens, builders will purchase basically a reimbursement policy for some sort of a obligor to provide the service in the years 2 through 10 on their homes. So you may, if you're looking at service contract books, you may end up running into new home warranties, even though that's not strictly a service contract like we described before. Other products, cell phone, month to month. They bill you at the time. Usually that coverage also covers things like loss and theft and for a deductible, and it's an interesting business there. We'll not get into a whole lot of detail. Home systems. You buy a house, not necessarily new, it's a resale house. You say, oh, how do I know the plumbing is not going to break next week? And they say, oh, not to worry, we've got this nice little coverage for you. It's going to cover all the systems. It's going to cover the plumbing, the electrical. It's going to cover HVAC, basically your heating, ventilation, air conditioning, your roof. You know, anything goes wrong, it's going to fix it for you. And it'll last for a year. And to tell you, you know, our seller really believes in his house so much he's going to even buy it for you. Well, that's a one-year contract. It's really a service contract. And when, you know, you've finished up and you're coming up to the end of that year, guess what? You get a little letter in the mail saying, hey, we can renew that for you. And, you know, if you think that your heater is going to go or your pool heater is about ready or air conditioner might be on the last legs, you might have some incentive to keep that going. But these are typically year-to-year type contracts covering major systems and often are endorsed to cover appliances like refrigerators and washers and dryers. As I said, often packaged with the sale of existing homes and annual coverage. Computers, electronics, you know, it's kind of standard three-year type things. But unlike most insurance products, there are often a lot of parties involved. You know, typically an insurance contract, you've got the primary carrier, the insurer, and the insured. You got one contract, two parties, and things are nice and easy. And well, with all the lawsuits and that, you never think they're easy, but you only have two parties to worry about. In a service contract, you can have several of them. The manufacturer could be involved. The seller of an item could be involved. The consumer usually is involved. An administrator of a service contract program might get into the act. A contract obligor, who could be different from the administrator, might be in the act. And there might be an insurer. So we have all of these folks to think about. And, you know, it could very well be that the same person, and here I mean legal person, so it could be a corporation, could have more than one role. So, you know, it's when you're looking at a service contract program or trying to evaluate, you know, the liabilities for a service contract program, it's key to understand what is covered and where along the chain you are. Service contract can be agreement between the manufacturer, seller, or other obligor and a consumer. It's usually, at that level, it's usually not regulated as insurance. Usually, we're in the one state where it will be, but typically outside of Florida, a seller or a manufacturer can offer a service contract on a product that they sell without any regulation from insurance. And the key here is without regulation. They can sell it for whatever they want. There is no price regulation at that stage. It's not an insurance product. You know, and what people don't recognize when you're in there in the F&I department, finance and insurance department, after you buy a car and they're sitting there, okay, you just got this deal where, hey, you know, how about this under seal and this protection stuff, and we got this service contract, you know, and they'll offer you the service contract for $2,000, and you say, that sounds like a pretty good deal. What you don't realize is that you can say, I'll offer you $1,000 for it, and you're going to be happy, and they'll say, yes, we are. Very often, service contracts, not just on vehicles, but even on electronics, are a major profit center for the seller, a huge profit center. For a new car seller, that could be where that dealer is making his or her money on a vehicle sale. He doesn't make it on the actual vehicle, usually. It's in the F&I department that he makes his money. At, you know, like Best Buy, they, with the internet and comparison shopping, there are very slim margins on electronics. But you don't know about the margins that they've got in their service contracts, you know, like the $39 displayer that they'll sell you the service contract for $39. You kind of figure there might be some margin in that sort of thing. But anyway, at this stage, it's not regulated as insurance. Party taking on the obligation to perform may, underline may, purchase an insurance contract to push off some or all of this risk. Now, so the key players are typically the obligor, the contract purchaser, and if you've got it, an insurer. Florida, as I said, our state here, is a marked exception. Broadly, it requires any service contract. This is technically not true, but effectively to be written by a service contract company that's regulated like an insurer. As I said, the sale is unregulated. Often the price is well above the expected cost and, you know, can be a large profit, immediate profit for the seller. And as I said, it's very common for the F&I department to generate the most profit for a new car sale. But when you're looking at a loss ratio, you really should know what your denominator is. Because if you're looking at the total premium, a loss ratio of 30% might be bad news. Whereas if you're looking at only the loss portion of the premium, a 100% loss ratio is break even. So you really should know what you're talking about. A rose is a rose. No. Something that you really need to watch out for when you're working with service contract people is the word reserve. We have a nice, very narrow meaning for the word reserve. They do too. Unfortunately, it has nothing to do with what we talk about in a service contract. And I can't stress this too often. When a service contract person talks about reserve, they are talking about the loss portion of the premium. Period. Not the actual losses, not something set aside for losses in the way we think of, but just the loss portion of the premium. Okay. And the reserve is the reserve. Once you've, you know, once you price a policy, the reserve is fixed. It never changes. Well, you know, boy, I'd love to say our reserves never change, but you know, they do. And you know, typically what they'll do is when they calculate their loss ratios, they'll calculate it against the reserve. So what you do is you think if you're looking at this kind of business, 100% is a break even, then they typically worry about their expenses afterwards. And one little bit of expenses, as we'll get into in a little bit later, is the admin fee, and we'll get to that. Some variations of insurance. Some service contracts are direct contracts between the purchaser and insured. That's typically, you know, except for, you know, little technical things, basically what you have in Florida. Like usual insurance, moderate to high expense provision, because there's often pretty high commissions in this stuff, 35-50%, it's not unusual. Then there's contractual liability policies that cover the obligor, the person who takes on the obligation to service the contract. And these are usually relatively small expense provisions with a separate admin fee going to the seller or the administrator. And who do you trust? And then there's another variation called the trust account. And this is a place where the obligor accepts the full contract cost, puts the reserve into a bucket that might accrue interest, but pays losses and some expenses out of that account. And whatever's left over at the end of the day is profit, either to him or the dealer or to both. And the obligor could then turn around and insure the trust on a policy year basis or on an aggregate stop loss basis. And these can get to be real interesting on the analytics. Now, follow the money. It's as I said, it's key in understanding what the economics and the profitability of these things are, in understanding how the cash flows go. And these following four are lifted straight from the paper. On a direct transaction like insurance, basically and all these examples, I'm going to just have $1,000 consumer cost involved, out of which is going to be $500 going to basically the seller. And then 360, so that's 72% loss ratio expected with an expense ratio of 140%, with the loss ratio covering profits. So here it's, you know, pretty much a standard kind of insurance transaction. You got the insurer sends up $500 commission to the seller, who's the dealer in this case. I'm going to be talking about cars. Now, the insurer will think in terms of having $140 of expenses on this account and $360 that it's going to set aside for losses. And, you know, since everything is perfect and we already know the price, they're going to pay exactly $360, so the reserve is equal to the reserve and everybody's happy. The next variation is what's called a dealer obligor. This is where the dealer or the seller can take on the obligation. In some states, this is required. So in this case, the purchaser hands the dealer a $1,000 check. The dealer then keeps $500 of it. That's why it sort of disappears. The dealer then sends a $100 admin fee to an administrator, which will cover things like policy administration and, you know, actuarial analysis or whatever, and then $400 to the insurer because the insurer is going to pay all the claims. The insurer then has $360 in reserve, kind of stuck away, and has got $40 for expenses and profit. The next one, it would be an administrator obligor. Now, in states where the dealer is not required to be the obligor, most plans like to have the administrator as the obligor. So this is a separate company. And in this case, I show two payments, you know, $500 going to the dealer and $500 going to the administrator. In reality, that's one $1,000 check cut to the dealer, which he then forwards to the administrator. But and again, $100 will go basically to the administrator. He'll keep $100 for profit, send $400 to the insurer. So other than that one little step, it looks like the prior slide, and the insurer keeps the $400 and puts $360 for reserves and then $40 for expenses. Now the most interesting and probably one of the most dangerous ones from an analytic point of view is a trust. Now here the top part looks just like the administrator obligor type program where, you know, you got the $500 going to the dealer for his markup, and the purchaser sent, you know, with $500 going to the administrator. But in this case, the administrator keeps $135 for expenses, puts $340 in, because out of this we're going to say $340 is the quote reserve, and put $340 into a trust account, sends typically like $25 to the insurer, and says, okay, you're here to cover me in case my trust fund runs out. Well, some of these things are written like a policy year, so you're going to cover me if the policies or if the trust fund I set up for this particular policy year runs out. Others are set up on an aggregate basis, and this one really gets fun. Well, you're going to cover me if my trust fund ever runs out of money. Now, if you think of that, it's a going concern type thing, so you've got money coming in, and if you're writing a lot of new car contracts where you don't get to pay losses for a while because of the underlying manufacturer's warranty, it could be a while before the losses show up, so you get all this cash flow coming in, and if you grow the business, the cash flow coming in on the new contracts can offset really bad losses on the old contracts. You could be in very, very deep water before you ever have a claim for which the insurer has been paid $25 a contract. In the appendix of the paper, I actually go through a situation which is not unrealistic, and basically you're writing at what ends up to be something like a 200% loss ratio, and you don't figure it out for like 7 years. And rack up $34 million in losses in the meantime. Not a pretty picture. This is very dangerous, and this has happened and sunk more than one, or at least one that I know of, but several programs. Anyway, financial considerations. Reserves in the insurance sense are typically kind of small. Loss reserves are like minuscule. These things are quick paying. It's very unusual to have claims hang around for more than a month or two. Even on a policy quarter basis, by the end of the quarter, I think typically I see like 75 or 80% paid out. By the end of the next quarter, it's like 95 or so. By the end of the year, it's virtually all dead. So loss reserves really aren't a big issue, usually. You know, if you have a large pipeline issue with your administrator or something, it can be, but typically loss reserves are not the big deal here. Whereas, since they're multi-year contract, your unearned premium reserve is where the pay dirt is. And this is where we usually don't pay attention. You know, the unearned premium reserve, all that's just, you know, money off the... You could be well underwater. A company can be well underwater in the UEPR, and it won't show up unless you actually, you know, look at the UEPR separately. And the problem is that the losses don't come in uniformly over time. new car contracts tend to have back-ended losses. Losses tend to come in toward the end of the contract. New car contract contracts on used items tend to be front-loaded. A lot of your consumer-type warranties tend to be somewhat back-loaded because you still have like a 3-month. Typically, on electronics, you got a 90-day manufacturer warranty. Like on TVs and that, you might go a year. So you're going to have low losses in the first bit and then building up. So you have non-uniform and also distributions that are not easy to predict early on. On the unearned premium on a GAAP basis roughly requires earning at the same rate that losses and expenses are expected to emerge. If you end up having a premium deficiency reserve gap, requires you to post additional accruals. On U.S. statutory, you have the long duration contract calculation. It's intentionally quite conservative. 3-way calculation for the minimum required reserve. People go through the calculation saying, this is the reserve. No, that's just the minimum. The NAIC says the UEPR will not be less than this calculation. You can have it more. So, it's if you're doing an opinion, in my view, and again, this is my personal view, if it's anything bigger than the required amount, you can say, yeah, it satisfies the laws. Whereas, it doesn't necessarily have to be reasonable. But so that's another, there's a whole nother issue there. And in my view, I think my personal view, I have real problems with the reasonability because I think the NAIC is too conservative in this. So, any case. But we're not going to get into that any more than that here. When you look at the performance of this, in my opinion, the best way to look at how a service contract program is performing is on a policy year or policy period, policy quarter basis. Look at ultimate losses for that year against ultimate premiums for that year, period. Typically what happens is in a lot of these programs, they'll give you calendar year loss ratios. Calendar year loss ratios can be very misleading because, this kind of approach is time consuming. It might not be practical when you have hundreds of different terms. It might be good enough to look at incurred losses against premiums earned, but be careful with that because the way you earn premiums is really critical to the way the loss ratios look. If you earn premiums too quickly, your loss ratios are going to look good for a while and then go to heck in a handbasket. So if you're going to be using earned premiums to monitor losses, Sometimes people will set the unearned premium reserve in such a way to match statutory UEPR. Sometimes they'll use pro rata, reverse rule of 78s, and they'll use actual emergence for old policies. All of these things can be misleading. But if you're going to use and rely on loss ratios against earned premiums, you really should test them. Compare the runoff of policy years. In other words, look at the policy year runoff over time. If the loss ratios just kind of zigzag around and look like they're just kind of meandering around an average, then you'll have a reasonable satisfaction that yes, they're tracking the losses pretty well. If they're consistently going up, maybe you're earning premiums too quickly. If they're consistently going down, maybe you're earning too slowly. Ken? The statutory calculation gives you three numbers. The statutory minimum unearned premium reserve has to be larger than those three numbers, period.
So you can basically set it to the highest of those three values.
I've seen carriers actually set it higher than that, but.
You have flexibility.
I don't see any rules that say you do not.
Back.
FASB, that's GAAP, not stat.
Yeah, I know, but even though we're an insurance company, they still, they claim FASB as being the only, so they make our statutory reserves, as our auditor, they make our statutory reserves, they call our GAAP reserves, and follow the FASB standards.
Even if they come in below stat?
No, no, never below stat. So ours are always above stat because of the FASB standards.
Okay, but...
And so they don't allow us to earn a straight line.
Actually... It really depends on your expense structure, because I've got a client that, you know, the three calculations, the return of premium calculation ends up being the largest of the three, which is a, you know, and the other two are basically the three there's three calculations. Two of them are effectively stat. I'm sorry, GAAP. And the first calculation is unique to stat. And it turns out in this one client that I'm thinking of, the first calculation is the one that dominates. So their statutory is well, their minimum statutory is well above their GAAP. But yeah, if I'm just saying on a statutory basis, you have to be above
right. The
minimum. It doesn't say, you know. Right. Actually, the pro rata is the one that won in that other case. But it again, the key here is what's a little bit funky is that you take into account losses and expenses. And if you have a heavy commission expense, that could throw the pro rata calculation high. And, you know, because the other two calculations look at loss and expense combined, so it effectively allows you to front end your commissions. Where you can't do that in a standard unearned premium calculation. You can effectively take out your commissions on the stat and GAAP calculations here, where you can't do that on a stat calculation usually. Anyway, trust but verify, understand the coverage, the contract period. On the trusts, is it aggregate or inception to date or other? Technically, there's no losses until the trust exhausts all the funds. So you can if you're insuring a trust, you can show a zero loss reserve, even if it looks like 2 weeks into next year the trust is going to blow through. A zero loss reserve is a zero loss reserve because they haven't broke through yet. If you're running an insurance company that runs insurance on trust, you really have to get down and figure out what's happening at the trust. There's just no way around it. It's just way too dangerous to... ignore that. And there's, you know, as I said, the appendix has a caution. There are some loss-sensitive features in contracts. They do, you know, have some one-way dealer participations. There's dealer rent-a-captives, and there's also dealer offshore captives and reinsurance-type arrangements. These are just ways to get money into the dealer's pocket and effectively ways that are tax-deferred for the dealer. Because they don't have, you know, if they keep their insurance company running there and they don't pull profits out, they don't get taxed on it until they close it down when they retire. So it's a way they can defer some income. So, you know, you ought to be looking at that. So in conclusion, this can be a profitable business if you know what you're doing. Don't be fooled by the short tail. It can be a very long tail cover. Sometimes simple shortcuts work but fail often enough that they ought to be periodically tested. And the market continues to evolve, making hard-won past experience less adequate to the task. And that's so true, because every time you think you got it handled, the marketing guys come up with a new idea. Anyway, thank you very much.
Save the audio?
It's already saved.
That's done. Okay.
Or shut down and save, you know, shut down this and save it.